The leaden sky seemed to hold its breath. December grew near, and still there was no snow in the valley. For several days, the thermometers held at 25 below zero. When Mabel went out to feed the chickens, she was stunned by the cold. It cut through her skin and ached in her hip bones and knuckles. She watched a few dry snowflakes fall, but it was only a dusting, and the river winds swept it against exposed rocks and stumps in small, dirty drifts. It was difficult to discern the scant snow from the fine glacial silt, blown in gusts from the riverbed that coated everything. Jack said people in town were relieved that the snow hadn't come. The train tracks were clear and the mine was running. But others worried the deep freeze would mean a late spring and a late start on planting. The days diminished. Light lasted just 6 hours, and it was a feeble light. Mabel organized her hours into patterns. Wash, mend, cook, wash, mend, cook, and tried not to imagine floating beneath the ice like a yellow leaf. Baking day was a small gift, a reason to look forward. When it came, she rose early and was taking out the bin of flour and can of lard when she felt Jack's hand on her shoulder. "No need," he said. "Why not? Betty told me to hold off on the pies. This week? For good. She's got her sister baking for her." "Oh," Mabel said. She put the flour back on the shelf and was surprised at the strength of her disappointment. The pies had been her only real contribution to the household, a task she took some pride in. And there's the money. "Will we have enough, Jack, without it?" "I'll work it out. Don't worry yourself about it." Mabel now recalled waking to find his side of the bed empty. He'd been at the kitchen table in wavering candlelight, papers spread in front of him. She had gone back to sleep, not thinking of it at the time. But this morning he looked so old and tired. He walked with a slight stoop, and as he climbed out of bed, he groaned and held the small of his back. When Mabel asked if he was all right, he mumbled something about the horse, but said he was fine. She started a fuss about him, but he waved her off. "Leave it be," he said. Just leave it be. Mabel brought him leftover biscuits and a hard-boiled egg for breakfast. "George Benson and his boys are coming over later today to help me skid logs," he said as he peeled the egg. He didn't seem to notice her stare. "George Benson?" she asked. "And who is George Benson?" "Hmm? What?" "I've never met the man. I know I've mentioned him before." He took a bite of egg, and with a half full mouth, said, "You know, he and Esther live just downriver from town." "No, I did not know. They'll be here in a few hours. Don't worry about lunch. We'll work on through. But figure 3 extra plates for dinner. I thought, didn't we agree? Why are they coming here?" Jack was quiet, and he got up from the table and picked up his leather boots from beside the door. He sat back in the chair, pulled them onto his feet, and laced them in quick, jabbing motions. "What am I supposed to say, Mabel? I need the help." He kept his head down and tugged the laces tight. "It's just that simple." He grabbed his coat from the hook, buttoning as he stepped outside, as if he couldn't wait to get out the door. George Benson and two of his sons arrived an hour or so later. The older boy looked to be 18 or 20, the younger not much more than 13 or 14. Mabel watched through the window as they met Jack at the barn. They shook hands all around, Jack nodding and grinning. The men gathered tools and headed toward the field, leading the team of draft horses the Bensons had brought. They never came to the cabin. She waited for Jack to look for her in the window, to give a wave as he sometimes did in the mornings, but he didn't. Evening came and Mabel lit the lamps and cooked a dinner for them. When the men came in from working, she would try to be gracious, but not overly friendly. She didn't want to encourage this. Jack might need help this particular day, but they were not in need of friends or neighbors. Otherwise, why had they come here? They could have stayed home, where there were people enough for anyone. No, the point had been to find some solace on their own. Hadn't Jack understood that? When the men returned, they didn't give Mabel 2 blinks. They weren't rude. George Benson and his boys nodded politely and said thank you and ma'am and please pass the potatoes, without ever really looking at her. And mostly they talked loudly to one another about workhorses and the weather and the crops. They joked about broken tools and the whole blasted idea of homesteading in this godforsaken place, and George slapped his knee and asked pardon for his swear words, and Jack laughed out loud, and the two boys stuffed their mouths full. All the while, Mabel stayed by the kitchen counter, just outside of the light of the oil lamp. They are going to be partners, she and Jack. This is going to be their new life together. Now he sat laughing with strangers when he hadn't smiled on her in years. Later after dinner, George dragged his tired boys to their feet and told them it was time to head home. "Your mother will be wondering where the devil we went to," he said. He nodded at Mabel. "Much thanks for the great meal. You know, I told Jack here that you two ought to come over our way sometime. Esther sure would like to meet you. Most of the homesteaders around here are grubby old bachelors. She could stand to have some female companionship. She should thank them for coming to help. And say she should be over any day now to meet his wife, but she said nothing. She could see herself through their eyes. An uptight, back east woman. She didn't like what she saw. After George and his boys left, she heated water in the wood stove and washed the plates, finding some satisfaction in the clatter, but her anger was deflated when she saw that Jack had long since fallen asleep in his chair. She was left with her own ineffective bustle and noise. Covering her hands with her apron, she picked up the basin of dirty dishwater, pushed open the latch on the door with an elbow, and stepped outside. She strode across the hard-packed yard and threw the water into a small ravine behind the cabin. Steam billowed around her and slowly dissipated. Overhead, the stars glittered metallic and distant, and the night sky seemed cruel to her. She let the cold air fill her nostrils and chill her skin. Here by the cabin, the air was warm. Here by the cabin, the air was calm. But she could hear the wind roar down the Wolverine River. Wolverine River. It was several days before Jack mentioned the Bensons again, but he broached the subject as if halfway into an ongoing conversation. George said we should come down about noon on Thanksgiving. I told him you'd make up one of your pies. He's missing them down at the hotel. Mabel didn't agree or protest or ask questions. She wondered how Jack could be sure she had even heard him. As she flipped through a recipe box, trying to decide what to bake, she thought of Thanksgivings back in the Allegheny River Valley, where Jack's aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents and grandchildren, friends and neighbors gathered at the family farm for the feast. Those days had been the worst for Mabel. Even as a child, she was uneasy with crowds, but as she got older, she found the bantering and prying even more excruciating. While the men walked the orchards to discuss business, she was trapped in the women's realm of births and deaths, neither of which she was comfortable turning into idle chat. And just below the surface of this prattle was the insinuation of her failure, whispered and then hushed as she entered and left rooms. Perhaps, the whispers went, Jack should have chosen a hardier woman, a woman who wasn't afraid of hard work and who had the hips for childbirth. Those highbrows might be able to discuss politics and great literature, but could they birth a child, for God's sake? Do you see the way she carries herself, like she couldn't turn her nose any higher? Back as straight as a stick. An oh-so-delicate constitution. Too proud to take in an orphan child. Mabel would excuse herself to go out of doors for some fresh air, but that only attracted the attention of a nosy great-aunt or well-meaning sister-in-law who would advise her that if she were only more approachable, more friendly, then perhaps she would get on better with Jack's family. Maybe it would be the same with the Bensons. Maybe they would presume her unfit to survive as a homesteader in Alaska, or judge her barren and cold and a burden to Jack. Already a pit of resentment grew inside her. She thought of telling Jack she was too ill to go. But early Thanksgiving morning she rose, well before Jack, put more wood in the stove, and began rolling out the dough. She'd make a walnut pie with her mother's recipe, and also dried apple pie. Was it enough, two pies? She'd watch the boys eat, swallowing great mouthfuls and cleaning plates effortlessly. Maybe she should make three. What if the crusts were tough, or they didn't like walnuts or apples? She shouldn't care what the Bensons thought. And yet the pies were to represent her. She might be curt and ungrateful, but by God she could bake. With the pies in the wood stove oven, Mabel chose a heavy cotton dress that she hoped would be appropriate. She heated the iron on the stovetop. She wanted to look presentable, but not like an overdressed outsider. When she was ready and the pies were done, she gathered wool blankets and face wraps for her and Jack. It would be a long, cold ride in the open wagon. After Jack had fed and watered the animals and harnessed the horse, Mabel sat beside him on the wagon seat, the still-warm pies wrapped in towels on her lap. She felt an unexpected shiver of excitement. Whatever happened at the Bensons, it was good to be out of the cabin. She had not left the homestead for weeks. Jack, too, seemed more chipper. He clicked his tongue at the horse, and as they followed the trail off their property, he pointed out to Mabel where he'd been clearing and told her of his ideas for the spring. He described how the horse had nearly killed him that day and how it had spooked at a red fox. Mabel threaded her arm into the crook of his. "You've accomplished a great deal. I couldn't have done it without the Bensons. Those workhorses of theirs are something else. Puts this beast to shame." He gave the reins a gentle shake. "Have you met his wife?" "Nope, just George and his sons. George used to be a gold miner when he was younger, but he met Esther and they decided to settle down and have a family." Jack hesitated, cleared his throat. "Anyways, he seems like a good man. He's sure been a help to us." "Yes, he has." When they arrived at the Bensons, someone came out of the barn hoisting a flapping, headless turkey. It was George, she thought at first, but this person was too short and had a thick gray braid hanging below a wool cap. "Must be Esther," Jack said. "Do you think so?" The woman raised her chin in greeting, then wrestled with the huge dying bird in her arms. Blood splattered about her feet. "Go on up to the house," she called out to them. "The boys will help you with the horse." In the cabin, Mabel sat alone at the cluttered kitchen table, while Jack disappeared outside George and the younger son. With her hands in her lap, her back straight, she wondered where they would eat. The table was heaped with stacks of catalogs, rows of washed empty jars, and bolts of fabric. The cabin smelled strongly of cabbage and sour wild cranberries. It wasn't much bigger than Jack's and Mabel's, except it had a loft where she assumed the beds were. The cabin was catawampus. Great word. Catawampus. In a dizzying way, with the floor dipping to one side and the corners not square. Rocks and bleached animal skulls and dried wildflowers lined the windowsills. Mabel didn't move, yet she pried just by allowing her eyes to wander. She jumped when the door banged open. "Blasted bird. You'd think you'd know enough to just give up the ghost. But no, it's got to raise hell when it doesn't even have a head left on its body." Oh dear, can I do something to help?" The woman stomped past the table without removing her dirty boots and threw the turkey onto the crowded counter. A lard tin fell with a clatter to the floor. Esther kicked at it and turned to Mabel, who stood flustered and slightly frightened. Esther grinned, stretched out a blood-stained hand. "Mabel? Isn't that it? Mabel?" Mabel nodded and gave her hand over to Esther's vigorous shake. "Esther, but I suppose you already figured that out. Good to have you here, finally." Under her wool coat, Esther wore a flower print shirt and men's denim overalls. Her face was speckled with blood. She pulled off her wool hat, and fuzzy strands of hair stood on end. She swung her braid over her back and began filling a large pot with water. "You'd think with all these men around here I could find somebody to kill and pluck a turkey for me, but no such luck." "Are you sure there's nothing I can do?" Perhaps Esther would apologize for her appearance or for the disarray in the house. Maybe there's some explanation, some reason. No, just relax and make yourself at home. You could fix us some tea if you'd like, while I get this damn bird in the oven." "Oh, yes, thank you. You know what our youngest son went and did? Here we raise a couple of turkeys for no other reason than to cook on occasions such as these, and he goes out and shoots a dozen ptarmigan?" There's a P in front of it. Is it ptarmigan? P-T? Ptarmigan? Ah! "He goes out and shoots a dozen ptarmigan yesterday. Let's have these for Thanksgiving," he says. "What do I need a dozen dead ptarmigan on Thanksgiving? Why feed turkeys if you're going to eat ptarmigan?" She looked at Mabel as if expecting an answer. I haven't the faintest idea. I can't say I've ever eaten ptarmigan before." "Well, it's good enough, but Thanksgiving, it's turkey as far as I'm concerned. I brought pies for dessert. I set them on that chair. I wasn't sure where else to put them." "Perfect. I hadn't had a chance to even think of the sweets. George tells me Betty's a fool to give up your pies. He raves about your baking. Not that he needs any of it. Have you seen the gut on that man?" Again, she looked to Mabel expectantly. "Oh, I wouldn't..." Esther's laugh was a loud, startling guffaw. "I keep telling him he's single-handedly supporting that hotel restaurant, and it's starting to show," she said. It was as if Mabel had fallen through a hole into another world. It was nothing like her quiet, well-ordered world of darkness and light and sadness. This was an untidy place, but welcoming and full of laughter. George teased that the two women were talking a blue streak rather than cooking the meal, and it was well into the evening before dinner was served, but no one seemed to mind. The turkey was dry on the outside and half raw on the inside. They all had to pick and choose their cuts. The mashed potatoes were creamy and perfect. The gravy was lumpy. Esther made no apologies. They ate with plates balanced on their laps. No one said a blessing, but George held up his glass and said, "To neighbors, and to getting through another winter." They all raised their glasses. "And here's to eating ptarmigan next year," Esther said, and everyone laughed. After dinner and pie, the Bensons began to tell stories of their time on the homestead, of how the snow once piled so deep the horses could walk over the fence whenever they pleased, of weather so cold the dishwater turned to ice in the air when you tossed it out. "I wouldn't live anywhere else in the world, though," Esther said. "What about you? You both come from farms down south?" "No. Well, Jack's family owns a farm along the Allegheny River in Pennsylvania." "What do they raise back there?" George asked. "Apples and hay, mostly," Jack said. "What about you?" Esther turned to Mabel. "I suppose I'm the black sheep. No one else in my family would think of living on a farm or moving to Alaska. My father was a literature professor at the University of Pennsylvania." "And you left all that to come here? What in God's name were you thinking?" Esther shoved Mabel's arm playfully. "He talked you into it, didn't he? That's how it often is. These men drag their poor women along, taking them to the far north for adventure when all they want is a hot bath and a housekeeper." "No. No, it's not like that." All eyes were on her, even Jack's. She hesitated, but then went on. "I wanted to come here. Jack did too, but when we did, it was at my urging. I don't know why precisely. I believe we were in need of a change. We needed to do things for ourselves. Does that make any sense? To break your own ground and know it's yours, free and clear. Nothing taken for granted. Alaska seemed like the place for a fresh start." Esther grinned. "You didn't fare too badly with this one, did you, Jack? Don't let word get out. There aren't many like her." Though she didn't look up, Mabel knew Jack was watching her and that her cheeks were flushed. She so rarely spoke like this in mixed company. Perhaps she had said too much. Then, as the conversation began to turn around her, she wondered if she had told the truth. Was that why they had come north? To build a life? Or did fear drive her? Fear of the gray, not just in the strands of her hair and her wilting cheeks, but the gray that ran deeper, to the bone, so that she thought she might turn into a fine dust and simply sift away in the wind. Mabel recalled the afternoon, less than 2 years ago, sunny and brilliant. The smell of the orchard in the air. Jack was sitting on the porch swing of his parents' house, his eyes shaded from the sun. It was a family picnic, but they were alone for the moment. She had reached into her dress pocket and pulled out the folded handbill. June 1918, Alaska, our newest homeland. "They should go," she had said. "Home?" he asked. "No," she said, and held up the advertisement. "North," she said. The federal government was looking for farmers to homestead along the territory's new train route. The Alaska Railroad and a steamship company offered discounted rates for those brave enough to make the journey. She had tried to keep her tone even, to not let desperation break her voice. Jack was wary of her newfound enthusiasm. They were both nearing 50 years old. It was true that as a young man he had dreamed of going to Alaska, of testing himself in a place so wild and grand. But wasn't it too late for all that? Jack surely had such doubts, but he did not speak them. He sold his share in the land and business to his brothers. She packed the trunks of dishes and pans and as many books as they could hold. They traveled by train to the West Coast, then by steamship from Seattle to Seward, Alaska, and by train again to Alpine. Without warning or signs of civilization, the train would stop and a solitary man would disembark, shoulder his packs, and disappear into the spruce trees and creek valleys. She had reached out and put her hand on Jack's arm, but he stared out the train window, his expression unreadable. She had imagined the two of them working green fields framed by mountains as tall and snowy as the Swiss Alps. The air would be clean and cold, the sky vast and blue. Side by side, sweaty and tired, they would smile at each other, the way they had as young lovers. It would be a hard life, but it would be theirs alone. Here at the world's edge, far from everything familiar and safe, they would build a new home in the wilderness and do it as partners, out from under the shadow of cultivated orchards and expectant generations. But here they were, never together in the fields, speaking to each other less and less. The first summer he had her stay in town at the dingy hotel where he built the cabin and barn. Sitting on the edge of the narrow mattress that had certainly bedded more miners and trappers than Pennsylvania women, Mabel considered writing to her sister. She was alone. The ceaseless sun never gave her a moment's rest. Everything before her, the lace curtains at the window, the clapboard siding, her own aging hands, was leached of color. When she left her hotel room, she found only a single muddy, deeply rutted trail beside the railroad tracks. It began in trees and ended in trees. No sidewalks. No cafes or bookshops. Just Betty, wearing her men's shirts and work pants and issuing endless advice about how to jar sauerkraut and moose meat, how to take the itch of mosquito bites with vinegar, how to ward off bears with a blowhorn. Mabel wanted to write to her sister, but could not admit she had been wrong. Everyone had warned her the territory of Alaska was for lost men and unsavory women, that there would be no place for her in the wilderness. She clutched the advertisement promising a new homeland and did not write any letters. When at last Jack brought her to the homestead, she had wanted to believe. So this was Alaska. Raw. Austere. Austere. Great word. A cabin of freshly peeled logs cut from the land, a patch of dirt and stumps for a yard, mountains that serrated the sky. Each day she asked, "Can I come with you to the fields?" But he said, "No, you should stay." He returned in the evenings, bent at the back and wounded with bruises and insect bites. She cooked and cleaned and cooked and cleaned, and found herself further consumed by the gray until even her vision was muted and the world around her drained of color. Mabel smoothed her hands across her lap, chasing the wrinkles in the fabric again and again until her ears caught a few of the words around her. Something about the mine north of town. "I'm telling you, Jack, don't give it another thought," George was saying. "That's a quick way to leave the world." Mabel kept herself calm and seated. "Did you say a coal mine?" she asked. "I know times are tough, Mabel, but that's nothing to be ashamed of," George said and winked at her. "You just keep your men at home and hang in there. It'll all work out." When George and his sons began to talk about the many gruesome ways a man can be maimed and killed underground, Mabel turned to Jack and whispered fiercely, "You were thinking of leaving me to work in the mine?" "We'll talk of it later," he said. "All you folks have got to do is get a moose in your barn and save your money for spring," George said. Mabel frowned, not comprehending. "A moose?" she asked. "In our barn?" Esther laughed. "Not a live one, dear," she said. "Meat, just to keep you fed. We've done it years past ourselves. You get mighty sick of mashed potatoes, fried potatoes, boiled meat, fried meat, but it'll get you through." "Pretty late in the year for moose," the youngest boy mumbled from where he stood in the kitchen, hands shoved in his pockets. He'd been better off getting one just before the rut. "They're still out there, Garrett," George said. "We'll just have to work a bit harder to find one." The boy shrugged doubtfully. "Don't mind him," Esther said, thumbing in the boy's direction. "He thinks he's the next Daniel Boone." One of the older sons laughed and punched him in the arm. The younger boy clenched his fists and then shoved his older brother hard enough to cause him to bump into the kitchen table. A noisy scuffle commenced, and Mabel was alarmed until she saw George and Esther taking no notice. Finally, when the ruckus became too much even for the Bensons, Esther hollered, "That's enough, boys!" And they settled down again. "Garrett might be too big for his britches, but I tell you, Jack, he is a hand with a rifle." George jutted his chin proudly toward the youngest boy. "He shot his first moose when he was 10. Brings home more game than all the rest of us." Esther leaned toward Mabel and said, "Including all those blessed ptarmigan." Mabel tried to smile, but her thoughts were unspooling. He was going to abandon her, leave her alone in that small, dark cabin. Now the men were all talking of hunting moose, and once again she had the unsettling sense that they had all conversed on this topic before, and once again she was the ignorant stranger. "You gotta carry your rifle with you, even when you're just working in the fields," she heard the youngest son tell Jack. "Get up in the foothills. Most times the snow had already pushed them down to the river. But it's late in coming, so they're still up high eating birch and aspen." The boy barely managed to conceal his disdain for Jack. "Too bad he didn't shoot one in the fall," he said. "You're gonna have to hunt hard. Moose only herd up during the rut. They're different then. Bulls go crazy through the woods, knock their bloody antlers into the trees, roll in their own piss, bawl for cows." "I heard something, a month or so back," Jack said. "I was out splitting wood and then something started grunting at me out of the woods. Then thwack, thwack, like somebody else was chopping wood. Bull moose. Calling to you, smacking his antlers against a tree. He wanted to fight you. He thought you were another bull." The boy almost smirked, as if Jack were far from the stature of a moose. Esther saw Mabel's discomfort but misunderstood it. "Don't worry, dear. You'll get used to moose meat. It can run a little to the tough, gamey side this time of year, but it'll keep you fed." Mabel gave a weak smile. When it came time to leave, the Bensons tried to insist on Jack and Mabel staying the night. But Jack said they needed to get home to care for the animals, and Mabel said thank you, but she slept better in her own bed. "It's cold out there tonight," Esther said as she helped Mabel into her coat. "We'll be all right. Thank you, though." Esther chucked a jar inside Mabel's coat, buttoned it for her as if she were a child, and straightened the collar. "Keep that sourdough starter warm on the way home, or you'll kill it for sure. I remember what I said about adding a bit of flour now and then." Mabel hugged the cool jar against herself and thanked Esther again. It was clear and windy. The moon lit the ruts of the trail and turned the land and trees to blues. As they rode away, Mabel looked back toward the lighted windows of the Benson home, and then she pushed her face down into her scarf. Jack cleared his throat. Mabel expected him to say something about his plan to go to the mine. She was prepared to be righteous in her anger. "They're quite the family, aren't they?" he said. She didn't speak at first. "Yes," she said finally. "They certainly are. Esther took a liking to you. What all did you two talk about?" "Oh, everything, I suppose." Mabel was quiet and said, "She asked why we never had children." "And?" "She said we can have their boys anytime we want them." Jack chuckled, and Mabel smiled into her scarf despite herself. And that was chapter 3.